Hello, one and all, and welcome to part one of a subject we've been wanting to cover since the beginning of the podcast. Today we travel through time and space to the conception of free radical design, and from there we'll be exploring the turbulent history of the company. And time permitting, we may begin to discuss the games too, but you know us. So I encourage you all to take a seat and prepare yourself, because it's time to split!
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to a very special episode. Like Zach said in the wonderful intro, this is a series that is near and dear to my heart. I think you say the same, don't you, Zach?
It's kind of where it all began for us, really.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, this is a big deal. We've spoken a little bit about the first time Splitters back in our PlayStation 2 episode. Obviously, the first time Splitters was a launch title for the console. We obviously always wanted to kind of dive into the subject a bit deeper because I think there's so much to discuss here, isn't there?
There is, yeah. We gave it a bit of a sprinkling in the PS2 episode, but it's kind of important now that we kind of take it back even beyond the first game, and we start at the conception of the company and work our way forward from there.
Totally. I think it's going to be a love letter definitely to the series, right? A series that obviously means so much to us, and like you said, where it all really started, right? You know, very fond memories of being a kid and playing this game with you, playing these games with you.
Yeah, lots of fantastic memories associated with that. Lots of hopes and dreams kind of dashed, then rekindled, then dashed again, then rekindled again. Mm. So it's been as much of a turbulent journey for us as the fans as it has been for the company. You know,
it's been wild. Yeah, it's been absolutely wild. So I think we're going to jump right into this. You know, and we're going to start at the very beginning with the company. So, Time Splitters, the entire series and the franchise itself was created by a studio called Free Radical Design. And Free Radical Design was formed by four individuals, David Doak, Steve Ellis, Carl Hilton, and Graham Norgate, in ye olde Stoke-on-Trent, of all places.
Yep, in the spring of 1999, just mm-hmm. before, obviously, the release of Time Splitters in 2000.
So. This is correct. All four of the individuals basically were, you know, friends. They were co-workers beforehand. They all met working at Rare. And obviously, I think if you probably know what Rare does, but if you don't know what Rare does, those are the guys that made games like Banjo-Kazooie, stuff like that.
Grabbed by the Ghoulies,
Perfect Dark, GoldenEye, and it was those last two games, GoldenEye and Perfect Dark, that basically were the last games that the group worked on at Rare. And it's kind of funny, really, because there is a lot of Perfect Dark and a lot of GoldenEye in Time Splitters, isn't there?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, just fundamental game mechanics alone, like you can see where the inspiration has been taken directly from the aiming system.
Aiming system for Time Splitters 1, right? It might as well literally be ripped straight out of GoldenEye.
Yeah.
Like it's identical almost. And you can definitely see a lot of that throughout the games. I think by the time number 3 came around, I think a lot of that had sorted to fade a little bit, didn't it?
I think the largest part of that was because I do honestly believe that the studio had realized that they had to start adapting with the times.
Modern trends, for sure, right?
That old style of aiming is fugly, to say the least, right? It's not user-friendly. It's helped by the little bit of auto-aim that you get in the games, but actually having to, you have to hold down a button and then you move the whole gun in your hand moves around like it's not even on the hinge.
It's like it's disjointed, isn't it? You can always bend it and put the gun back on yourself, can't you? Yeah. And that's the angle you can kind of get on it, which is very strange.
Great for shooting around walls, but, you know.
Incredibly great.
Not much else.
Just like you said there, it is a relic of a past time, I think, and something that definitely, like you see in other older games, obviously, right? And something that is sort of akin, I think, to like Resident Evil, right? And the tank controls Resident Evil. It's like a game design of a bygone age.
Yeah. It's something that has to evolve. Otherwise, it's destined to be left in the dust.
Completely. So the studio itself would go on to create three games in the Time Splitters series. That's 1, 2, and 3. Or the third one, sometimes just referred to as Future Perfect, right?
Yes.
They also did a cancelled third Star Wars Battlefront game, which we touched on a little bit, I believe, in one of our episodes. I remember us having a chat about that, right?
We did, yeah.
There was a very strange time where they were working on a potential third Battlefront game, which was almost done. They also did a sci-fi game known as Second Sight as well. I know you're quite a fan of that game, aren't you, Zach?
That was Codemasters, I think. I think they published that.
They published it, but Free Radical made it.
Free Radical made it, but yes. it was published by Code because they were with Eidos for the first two Time Splitters games. So they kind of they split away from their initial publisher, obviously, yeah, to do Second Sight, and then even with Time Splitters 3, they decided then to go with EA parting ways with Eidos. Second Sight's kind of that's quite an interesting one, to be honest. There's a lot going on with that one as well.
I never touched Second Sight that much, but I do know of it, and I do know the character looks a lot like the character in Time Splitters 2.
Yeah, it does. It definitely bleeds Time Splitters for sure. I think from memory, it's kind of a lot of it is kind of more focused on because it's a third person game as well. It does have a bit of a different feel to it.
Yeah.
But there are lots of kind of different kind of scenarios and settings in that compared to Time Splitters. Like there's more of an emphasis on stealth in Second Sight.
It's more of like an actual single player game, isn't it? Like a single player experience.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like it doesn't have that kind of arcade feel that you're used to in the Time Splitters games.
Exactly. And not just this, obviously, there would be one last game that they would create, which was the university poorly received game known as Haze, which I remember getting way back in the day. And I'll be honest, maybe it was my naivety, maybe it was my love for the studio, but I didn't actually think it was as bad as people made it out to be. Looking back on it now, it was quite bad, but I honestly don't think it deserved the kind of venom that got spit at it.
Well, yeah, it is so say the game that killed the company, right? And I've got a couple of quotes here from PlayStation Magazine. They're kind of just saying that it fails to be better than Unreal Tournament 3, Resistance Fall of Man, Call of Duty 4, all games that were out at the same time. It kind of feels like a novel idea that missed its window of opportunity, kind of saying that it's kind of like it hasn't caught up with the modern day shooter.
It almost came out in like a for the old systems, right?
Maybe it should have been on the PlayStation 2 rather than being where it is.
The company was a bit too rooted in its heritage, right?
Yeah. But they do, as a kind of a counter to that, they do say that it does have a certain charm to it, which I think can be
said for
every game that Free Radical has done. There's that kind of like satirical flair to it that they do seem to capture really well. But ultimately they did finish by just kind of saying that it's worth a look, but the shabby visuals and the unfulfilling plot, dull set pieces, it just means it's not going to hold any kind of credence in our memories. It's a one and done kind of game of a bygone era, like you said.
Yeah. And sadly, after Haze's release and extremely poor reception, the company slipped into financial administration. That, coupled with the subsequent cancellation of the rumored Battlefront 3 game, it was eventually acquired by German developer Crytek, which was quite good. Crytek are a very big company. And this was after many, many rumors of the studio being completely shut down. And this is obviously still around a time where, game magazines were still quite active, right? Game magazines were still quite popular as well. I remember reading lots of stuff about Haze when it first came out in PlayStation 3 mags and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of rumors about the company. So Crytek stepped in, took over the company around the 2009 period, and they actually made what's rumored to be a £50 million investment in the studio.
Yeah,
which is quite big.
Changing the name over to Crytek UK then. So the studio became known as Crytek UK.
Exactly.
Between 2009 and 2014.
So for intents and purposes, you could sort of say that was kind of the end of Free Radical, but not necessarily the end of actually the studio, because a lot of the original staff were still on board at this time. However, and regrettably, during Crytek's ownership of the studio, not a lot happened really at all. But rumours did fly around for quite a long time of a fourth Time Splitters game happening. I don't know about you, Zach, but I remember actually seeing this once again in game magazines and actually news sites at the time. There was a ton of rumoured leaked images that came out about Time Splitters 4.
Yeah, and the thing is, I think looking back on it now, I feel like our speculation of the Time Splitters games getting a revival, very much in the same vein as like with where people are now in limbo with the Silent Hill games. We just like,
you're not wrong. Yeah.
We were hoping, and we were just jumping at shadows, just trying to find anything that could prove that it was going to happen. Mm. But ultimately just, you know, it wasn't meant to be at the time.
Yeah.
And in hindsight, kind of sidestepping a little bit here, I kind of hope that if that is what happened, that's what's happened with Free Radical and Time Splitters, hopefully maybe that's what's going to happen with Silent Hill. You know, who knows?
Fingers crossed, right? We always dream about a return to Silent Hill.
there are definitely, you know, there's definitely room for it, and there's still definitely a market for it for both of the, you know, Time Splitters and Silent Hill.
Oh, completely,
And the thing is, they've gone on record as well of saying that they weren't sure at the time whether there was going to be a demand, whether anybody actually wanted to continue to play Time Splitters, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's no doubt, right, that Time Splitters has become a cult classic, right?
Yeah, it has a dedicated fan base.
It has a hugely dedicated fan base, a hugely passionate group of people that play it and still maintain it today. For a lot of people, like I said with me and you, for them, it was that feel-good game, right? That sort of takes them back to their childhood. Yeah. In a way, you know, to a much simpler time, right? A way more simpler time when not just in games, but in life in general, right? Times were way more simpler back then.
Yeah. But to a younger audience without that emotional investment, is it going to have the same impact?
Will it hit? Yeah. And the key is obviously that redefining of what they want to do with the project. At the time, it's quite funny. We say that actually, because some of the images that surfaced were some kind of mock-ups of the monkey character as characters from other video games.
Yeah,
do you remember seeing the
Master Chief one, right?
Master Chief one, yeah. They also did a Gears one, didn't they? The cog symbol.
They did, yeah.
They had the cog symbol as the monkey face. So they were sort of tying into relevant gaming icons of the time, especially games like Gears of War, right, which were huge, huge during that era of consoles, you know, wasn't it? Like when the Xbox 360 came out, Gears of War was a massive deal, wasn't it? Huge deal. Halo, huge as well, but not counting Halo because it obviously came out a generation before that. But Gears was like fresh, wasn't it? You know, brand new IP at the time.
It was, but both of them, you know, absolute Microsoft juggernauts.
Oh, of course.
Halo
was
still going strong at that
point. Yeah, they're definitely not discounting it at all. Halo was obviously way up there, right?
Yeah.
So there was a lot of rumors about this game's development. I remember seeing all sorts of stuff regarding it. And everyone was basically crossing their fingers, hoping that a Transport 4 was happening. Sadly, that wasn't the case. The studio basically went on to work on the Homefront series of games. Now, I don't know if anyone knows about the Homefront series. I don't know how much you know about the Homefront games, Zach. I remember playing the first one ages ago, and I didn't really like it that much, to be honest. I found it kind of generic.
I only really ever saw the cover art. I'll be honest with you. It's never been a game I've ever picked up.
Yeah.
On kind of face value, it kind of reminded me a little bit of like... maybe like a more modernized Conflict game.
It was in a way sort of. It also had a bit of a strange storyline. Well, I don't know, really a strange storyline, but I guess something a bit different to the kind of war games we had before. It was set with like, I think it was Korea or something, wasn't it? Korea took over America, or Korea invades America or something like that.
Alternate
history kind of deal.
There are a lot of those right now, and you know, definitely they've been overshadowed by the likes of stuff like Wolfenstein, right? Mm,
yeah.
They've got that corner of the market by the bollocks, haven't they?
You know, yeah, absolutely. Right. Exactly.
To stand out in that kind of that niche corner of that market, they've got to have something spectacular.
Yeah.
And like you said, if it's quite underwhelming, it's no real surprise why it kind of slips under the radar for a lot of people, right?
No. So Homefront came out, and then the company Crytek UK began working on a sequel to the first game called Homefront: The Revolution. And sadly, this is where the story takes a bit of a sad turn. In the mid-2014 period, rumors started to emerge from the studio that employees were missing wages, missing bonuses being withheld in some cases. And this is obviously, you know, not what you want to hear, right? It's not exactly a good response for the studio. And because of this, a large chunk of employees obviously refused to work and filed grievances with Crytek over it. This situation, coupled with a lot of people leaving the studio in the previous years beforehand, you know, starting in about 2011, it sounds like morale at this time was pretty low, right?
Yeah, just taking a nosedive. You know, the thing is, right, it just seems like it was a bit of a PR nightmare. They weren't able to keep everybody happy.
Yeah.
And when you get to that point, you know, it's a case of it's a make or break. People are either gonna be satisfied with the outcome or they're gonna leave, right?
Exactly. It's never an easy thing, right, at all. And if it's, you know, obviously we can't talk about people that were there, we weren't involved with this or anything like that. So full respect to people that did go through it, if you know it did happen like that. But obviously it's like when money and, you know, wages start being like taken away and stuff like that, that's obviously quite a serious situation, isn't it? You know?
Oh, it is, absolutely.
Because at the end of the day, these are, you know, a lot of people do forget that, you know, these are businesses, right? These are people that work there. And at the end of the day, they are a business making money. And there are people at the other end of that, right, that need that money to pay their bills, you know, feed their family, all sorts, right?
Definitely. You know, like we may enjoy the games from an entertainment perspective, but there's still hundreds of hours that have gone into that. Somebody's hard work has gone into making that product, right?
So definitely.
You know, and realistically, those people, they need to be adequately compensated for the time and the effort that they put into it, right?
Completely. So in around July 2014, Crytek did publicly admit that the company was in a, and I quote, transitional phase. But this was after they were denying there were any issues with the studio and that there had potentially been issues ranging all the way back in 2011 when they had the big kind of employee kind of leaving situation going on. And shortly after this, you know, transitional phase announcement happened, Crytek announced the sale of the Homefront IP to Koch Media, who you might have heard of before. They are a parent company of the publisher Deep Silver, who you also might have heard of before.
Yes, yeah.
For certain games like Dead Island, right?
Yes, yeah.
Comes to mind, Dead Island. And basically during this kind of big period, there was, you know, a huge, massive internal restructure, which sadly saw a lot of people laid off and a lot of people lost their jobs over this. Obviously, people that did leave eventually transitioned to a new studio, and that studio was later called Dambuster Studios, which is still open to this day, and are still doing bits and bobs. But to be honest, I couldn't actually find out a lot about what they're working on nowadays, to be real with you. They obviously did the Homefront sequel, which is Revolution, which we're going to talk about a bit in a minute. I'm not too sure what else they've done or they're currently working on, to be honest.
I think I like the logo, though.
The logo's really good, actually. I quite like the logo. Sort of looks like a more violent Bullet Bill, doesn't it?
Yeah,
from Mario. Yes, yeah. That's what I instantly saw.
A little bit like Bruce from Finding Nemo when he smells the blood.
Yeah, Bruce from Finding Nemo, like face swapped onto Bullet Bill's body. obviously, this new studio was then formed and was announced. And Crytek, you know, finally announced the closure of Crytek UK after this whole change happened, thus officially marking the end of, you know, Free Radical as a company, right? And removal from their home base.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of a big kind of momentous occasion, but not in a good way.
Not in a good way, no. Very sad way, right?
Yeah. We heard the news, right? And we were like, that's it, mate.
A company that had been on the top for so long, you know, a company that had started from the beginning, really, of the PlayStation 2 era. You know, you have to go back to listen to our three-part series on the PS2 to know how big of a deal that console was. And how many companies, you know, got their start on that console and how many of those companies still exist today, you know, legends like Naughty Dog, Santa Monica Studios, Insomniac, you know, making incredible experiences on those games. And they're still going to this day. And, you know, sadly, another one of the titans hasn't made that jump, right?
It was incredible, you know, to think, you know, it's a game studio with a wealth of knowledge of over 15 years, right?
15 years, yeah.
And it was just gone like that.
And not only that, even beforehand, right? You know, the original founders, like we said, the four guys who came from Rare, and also more employees coming from Rare as well over time as the games were developed, you know, more people came over. So in a way, it started to look like a bit of an offshoot, right, from Rare, you know? And Rare, obviously, a company that's existed for so long. They've done, you know, countless games, like we said, and even going back to, you know, the N64, right, with the Donkey Kong Country games.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Massive, you know, really kind of illustrious pedigree there.
Huge pedigree, right? Huge pedigree.
Yeah, the kind of the skills and the experience.
So it is a shame, really, to see that, you know, their company kind of went that way, you know, compared to everything else. So that is officially catalogued as the end of Free Radical as we knew it in 2014. I want to touch on a little bit something else just before we kind of start diving into actually the meat and potatoes of this, which is, you know, obviously the Time Splitters series itself, and that's the rather curious Easter egg which was discovered only last year, in fact. So fresh news, right, Zach?
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
It's fresh news.
Kind of a bit of a weird one, came out of nowhere. Actually buried somewhere within the game files, right? There are there is a HD remake of Time Splitters 2.
And this currently exists as kind of the only real official, basically official port of the game to a modern-ish system. So obviously we spoke about Homefront and Homefront the Revolution. This was, you know, Crytek UK's last title they worked on before they officially, you know, debranded, kind of shut down and became Dambuster Studios, which obviously went on to release the game. So in that kind of first few years, I guess, at Dambuster, a lot of the original Free Radical guys were still kicking about. And basically, they put in an Easter egg in Homefront Revolution, which was a Time Splitters 2 arcade machine, which could be found a few hours into the game in one of the levels, in like a cafe or something like that. There's like a Time Splitters 2 arcade machine. And this was well known basically for a long time. It could actually be used, and the players could actually play the first two story missions in Time Splitters 2, which was like Siberia and I think Chicago, right?
Yes, that's right.
If I'm remembering those correctly.
I just remember remembering correctly, yeah.
The funky soundtrack of Chicago, you know. So, so good. We'll talk about that more in the next episode when we go through the other games. But, oh my God,
it's
Chicago.
The saxophone, man.
The soundtrack was so banging for that. Even the Siberia soundtrack, you know, had something about it. It was a little bit haunting, I think, in some places.
I'll be honest with you. Like, I think out of all of them, Time Splitters 2 had the best soundtrack.
Time Splitters 2 did have a banging soundtrack. Yeah.
I think it has the best soundtrack. But again, like you said, we will discuss that later.
Definitely, 100%. Yeah. So this game, this arcade machine was well known for a very long time to fans. But fans always speculated that maybe there was more to this than, you know, remains to be seen. And you know what? They were completely right. Because only last year, a programmer by the name of Matt Phillips commented on a Twitter thread that was entitled Game Devs, Please Respond with the Best Easter Eggs You've Ever Left in a Game, where he came out and admitted that he actually hid the full playable version of the game in 4K within Homefront, which is kind of wild, right?
Yeah.
Immediately, as soon as this happened, right, the internet kind of lit up and everyone was like, what the fuck? I think I remember us talking about this briefly, right?
Yeah.
Back in the day, because we were like, what is this madness? You know, it's not every day you see a Time Splitters article on like front page of a game journal website, right? Especially last year, like nothing was happening, you know, franchise was still pretty dead. Obviously we had the remake, which we'll talk about in a little bit of time, but you know, that was all kind of up in the air and there wasn't really anything, you know, truly official, right? So to see that kind of front page coverage was like, what the fuck's going on? Have we gone back in time?
I fully expected, you know, just like gold to start raining from the sky, you know.
It's finally happening, boys. Raining cats
and
dogs.
The end of days is upon us.
Things can fly. Yeah, there could be no other reason why this is happening. It can't be real. So he went on and started to go into more detail about this, basically. And he said that it started as a bit of an office joke between most of the staff, you know, at that point, because obviously a lot of people, like we said, had come from Free Radical, come from Crytek UK. And at the time, they obviously still own the rights to the game as well, even if they didn't end up doing anything with it, which is sort of a bit of a sad point about the franchise as well, right? That the rights kind of got fucking piggybacked around, didn't they? And sort of fucking bounced around from different studios, you know?
Yeah.
There was a time where it was sort of like, let's see who owns the license this week, right? Because it seemed to be almost changing hands all the time, with studios just kind of sitting on it and doing nothing with it, you know?
Sadly, it's pretty commonplace these days.
It is, especially for a game like this, right? Time Splitters always had a big pedigree. The IP was always interesting and I guess kind of tantalizing to players and to developers, but it was, I guess, the commitment required to actually make a sequel game was just too much for them.
Yeah.
Is this scenario better than the Konami scenario, which I'm going to dub it now, you know, sitting on your IP and doing nothing with it? I don't know. you pick, you choose if that's better or not. I kind of think this is a bit better because it sort of at least shows that people are wanting to acquire a license, right? With the intention to maybe do something rather than sitting on it.
I mean, I wonder if there are even other studios that have tried to acquire it from Konami and they've just told them.
I mean,
to
potentially,
get off, right?
You know, yes, a little side tangent about Silent Hill. But obviously there has been a lot of rumors, you know, regarding other companies want to buy it. There was a massive rumor last year about Sony wanting to buy it, which was debugged. It wasn't actually true. Great shame, because I could see them doing a good job of that.
I'm amazed that Kojima hasn't made a play for it.
There was still talk about Kojima as well, obviously, right? But that whole thing ended on kind of bad blood. I was hoping my like ideal situation would be for Sony to buy it and just give it to Kojima to do.
Yeah.
You know, that would be my intention. But then obviously, you know, would the game come out on PC if that happened? Probably not. Would it be a PS5 exclusive? More than likely. which would be a bit sad.
Silent Hill game, so suck it up and buy a PS5.
I would have a Silent Hill game, yes, and I probably would have to buy a PS5 if that actually happened, which is a shame. because that is probably the only game that would probably twist my arm to the level where I'd have to do that.
But I mean, only if it's like Silent Hill 2, Silent Hill 3 goodness. If it's Homecoming.
If we're hitting the same notes as PT hit, you know, that would be a purchase.
Oh, yeah, or PT, absolutely, yeah.
You know, if you went back to the board and we went PT and we actually did the full game, right, then fucking my man.
I'll go money out would be on a PS5.
Money would be thrown down immediately, mate. You know, I would commit unspeakable acts to obtain a PS5 if they were like, everything's coming back on, boys. PT is actually happening. It's always been happening. This has been a massive ploy for years. I'd go out and I would find and acquire a PS5 within a heartbeat. no doubt, mate.
Well, you heard it here first, folks, right, on the podcast. And we'll do unspeakable. He'll do anything.
Anything for a PS5 if PT came to an exclusive. But I'm kind of hoping maybe if Konami are actually telling the truth, because they claimed they are working on 2 or 3 Silent Hill projects. I don't believe them, but they claim they are. I'm hoping if they are doing it themselves or doing it to another studio, that studio loves themselves, you know, more than just the PlayStation. A PC version would be lovely. I would also not even care for a Epic Store version. You know, that would be fine as well.
Yeah, because anything that goes to the Epic Store eventually gets everywhere.
It does. And I don't really find the Epic Store that bad, to be honest. It's okay. It's not really a problem.
Me personally, I don't mind the wait. I'm happy I'm happy.
That also works as well.
I'm a patient man these days.
But anyway, enough about Silent Hill. Let's take it away from that.
Yeah.
Back to this fantastic Easter egg. So
we've done our obligatory sidestep.
That was an obligatory sidestep. It's not just relevant to the news episodes. We do it here as well. That's what we call consistency.
Yes.
So Matt obviously went on this big Twitter thread, which is really interesting, by the way. I might have to actually link it in the attached for this episode, so if you want to read it, because it's very interesting. He actually came out and said that it was actually possible for multiplayer to work with it. If someone had enough effort and enough time, they could actually do that, which I think is kind of mad. So he admitted that he ported the full multiplayer code for the game as well and piggybacked it onto Homefront's own cooperative mode and the code for that, but he hid it in the framework. You know, because he was concerned, obviously, it might cause issues with Homefront's own co-op system. And it didn't actually do that. But it does mean, and he has said this, that if someone had enough patience and had a lot of backwards hacking, you know, they could actually potentially make a multiplayer session of the game with 2 copies of Homefront and a server to run it on.
A little bit of reverse engineering for you.
A little bit of reverse engineering, quite a lot of reverse engineering. But apparently it is totally doable and hypothetically good work. He has stated this a few times on his Twitter thread. So who knows, man? If someone can actually get out there and do that, you could be looking at a 4K PC official port, fully playable cooperative of Timesplitters 2. So
sign me up.
Sadly, as I said before, 2 levels were only ever playable. And like I said, the community had a feeling that something was going on with this for a while now. And they'd actually been searching for how to potentially find more, because obviously Matt's thread had sort of sparked this up again, because he admitted that the full game was playable, the very full game, not just the first 2 levels, but everything, including arcade as well. He said that to get further, it required a code. And sadly, he actually lost the code. It was wrote in a notebook and he threw the notebook away.
Oh no.
Which is kind of wild, right? So everyone was like, oh my God, it's gone. You know, however, he did state that he did hand the code to a few friends beforehand for safekeeping, just in case. And ironically, just like clockwork, Q, one of those old friends, a dude by the name of Spencer. I'm going to say his second name is like, I can't really pronounce it because it's French. I think it's French. I want to say Perrette or Perret, maybe some of that. So apologies for butchering the pronunciation.
So Spencer.
But the Spencer fellow,
yep,
actually had the codes on him. And this is where it gets ridiculously funny. So him and Spencer were chatting beforehand, before kind of Matt went public with the story on Twitter, and told them to dump the codes in a Discord server. It doesn't actually say kind of on news reports and whatnot what Discord server this was, but I'm having a feeling it was probably either a Homefront one or a Timesplitters one, or maybe just a server that was dedicated to kind of find out the truth, you know, behind the games.
Yeah.
And he went into his server and actually dropped the codes in there. And within minutes, the Discord moderators of that server banned him completely within minutes of posting it, and claimed that he was just trolling and he was putting it in there without any kind of background or any kind of, you know, anything like that. He was just like, nah, you're taking the piss, which I find incredibly funny, right?
It's the boy who cried wolf, though, right?
Yeah.
There are so many people out there that do pull silly shit like that.
Totally, right?
You can't blame the mods, can you?
This was a dedicated group of fans, right, that were really sitting there and really going through this and really kind of being like, oh my God, how do we access more of this game, right? Because this is a big fucking deal, you know? Potentially the only official port of TileSplitters, and it's hidden. It's hidden in Homefront. It's hidden in the second Homefront game, right? Which, spoilers, also reviewed sort of badly, just like the first one. Yeah, so not an immensely popular game.
But worth getting, you know, for the HD TileSplitters too.
Well, now it is, yeah. So Spencer obviously, you know, turned back up on the same Twitter thread and basically dropped the codes again. And obviously this time people actually took notice of it, tried it, and it worked completely. And it unlocked the full game, the full TileSplitters 2. There was also a bit of reach out by a user from that Discord forum who was called Sandwave. And she actually did some digging on Spencer, found out he worked for Microsoft nowadays as a software engineer. So, you know, he's got some computer background, probably legit that he knows it. She reached out, had a conversation with him, and confirmed with Discord screenshots that he was actually the guy who had the code originally from Matt. They were friends. It was all connected, you know, and it was 100% legit. And since then, she also dumped from him the follow-up codes as well. So the codes to unlock every other section. So there were separate codes for the arcade mode, the challenge mode, and the campaign mode. So finally, you know, you can play TileSplitters 2 on every version of Homefront Revolution on PC as well. Which is kind of wild, right? So as of 2022, you can play the first official 4K remaster of this game, and it's hidden in a game from 2016.
Ridiculous.
Absolutely staggering. It was ridiculous news. It was unbelievable news last year. Like, it was covered on all the gaming sites. Everyone was talking about this fucking ridiculous story. And I just think it's crazy that, you know, these mad lads actually hid the entirety of TileSplitters 2 in Homefront.
Right. The audacity.
I think it's crazy.
The unmitigated gall.
But I praise their service, you know. Because of that, we now have another avenue to play TileSplitters. TileSplitters 2, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And totally official as well. Who would have thought?
Yes, it's mad. It is.
Why TileSplitters 2 was chosen, I'm not too sure. But I imagine because it wasn't as demanding as TileSplitters 3 was. But it was more content full than TileSplitters 1 was.
Yeah, because I mean, in all realism, it was only supposed to be a little Easter egg, you know, like with the. I've already spoken about Wolfenstein today, but you know, like when you could go and you could play on the arcade machines and play Wolfenstein 3D in the new Wolfenstein games,
which is quite good. And obviously,
it's only supposed to be something like that, right?
You can also do it with Doom as well, can't you? With the Doom 2016,
you can. Yes,
you can play the old levels if you get the secret areas, which I thought was really cool. I quite like that. Very, very cool idea, especially because it plays the retro music as well.
It does, yeah.
Proper good. So that's fantastic. Like, I just love how it's like, you know what, fuck it, just throw the whole game in there. throw the entire game in there as sort of a homage. And that truly is that homage to Free Radical, you know, to the studio they used to be. Because at that point, like I said, it was still kind of composed of mostly people from Free Radical. So everyone was kind of on board with it, right? On board with kind of, I guess, preserving that legacy, you know. Of TileSplitters.
Yeah, that's it. And I mean, speaking of preserving the legacy, you know, there are even the fan base. We've already spoken about the dedicated fan base, but in the interim, you know, when we in those kind of dark days when we thought
all hope was lost,
there's going to be no TileSplitters. This is it, right?
This is it, boys.
There's an entire group of dedicated individuals that are working on a remake called TileSplitters Rewind.
This is true. This is 100% true. Right. So you are correct. Like, this is a group of dedicated fans, literally just fans, no one else. This is all done by them, and they're essentially HDing, remaking, remastering the very first TileSplitters game, right?
So it's going to be
with elements of two as well. Yeah,
it's going to be elements of all of the games. I think.
Okay. I think they're going for that.
What they want to do, I think their end goal is to have elements from all three in one. But it's only going to be the arcade style. I don't think they're going to go with the
story.
I don't think they're going to bother with the story.
No,
but they are going to, because the idea of it is that they're going to fully revive the multiplayer for it.
Yeah.
So it'll be a case that all of those, every gun from every different game will be available.
It will sort of be like the ultimate kind of combined mode, right, from 1, 2, and 3 in a multiplayer sense.
The best way that I could probably describe it is Time Splitters All-Stars.
It's that's, a smash that, of Time Splitters.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a HD All-Stars for Time Splitters. So, you'll have, and I think they've done the challenge mode as well, if I'm not mistaken, because I've seen a few bits of footage where they're throwing the bricks through the windows, which is one of the challenge modes, right?
Nice, nice. So I hope they bring back the electric monkey dancing one.
Oh yeah, that was great. Yeah.
That one was fantastic. With the banging soundtrack in the nightclub level as well.
Oh mate, yeah.
Oh, that's such a good soundtrack.
You could get so carried away. The progress that they've made is fantastic.
It is staggering, considering it is a fan run operation, right? It's incredible.
It's an unfunded studio. They don't have any. They can't make any money from it because it's an IP that's not owned by them, right?
Obviously, and an IP that's also, as we said, been so volatile these past years.
Yeah, yeah. So I've got a little bit of hope that the Free Radical, as it is now, I hope they reach out to those guys and thank them for keeping it alive, because they really have. They in their own way have kept Time Splitters relevant.
You're not wrong. They have been flying the good flag, right, for a while now, and they've been really pushing the Time Splitters angle. And obviously, before we sidestep into talking about the first game and going into big detail about the first game, let's end this section with some very positive news. And that positive news, Zach, is that obviously Free Radical exists again.
They do, yeah.
Shockingly, right? Who would have fucking thought, right, that the company that's had this turbulent history, ironically, very recently as well, has been announced by Deep Silver that Free Radical has been reborn again.
Yep, as of May last year.
Incredible.
2021. And it's a revival, and they are working on an untitled Time Splitters game as we speak.
Which, is going to, for all intents and purposes, be, finally, the fourth Time Splitters game, right? It's incredible. Yeah. It's absolutely staggering times for the franchise, right? This is a games company, as we've just kind of talked about in this past half an hour, that has had such turbulence and such sadness and such unfortunate kind of events. It's incredible to finally see that they're going to come back. The game's going to come back.
Right? Yeah, I was blown away by the news, and it's such a good feeling to know that all of that waiting it's going to bear some fruit at some point.
It's going to happen, right? And let me be clear, this is early days. We are talking early days. I don't know how early it is, but I mean, their website at the moment is very bare bones. It's basically just a page with job adverts on it.
Yeah.
They're just looking for everyone and everything at the moment. A lot of pre-production stuff, I imagine, is going into effect here. But holy hell, it would be unbelievable to kind of be on board with that team, because two of the original people, I think David Doak and I think Steve Ellis, those two, I'm pretty sure those two are actually back in and leading part of the development on it. So two of the original founding members, obviously, on board, which is fantastic. A fantastic sign as well for the future of the game. And I mean, praise Deep Silver for being the ones to actually pull it off, Finally, it looks like we're going to get Time Splitters 4.
Yeah, it is. It's a really... really fantastic moment in gaming history, I think, for us.
You are not wrong at all, man. It is literally history being made. And it's quite funny you said, obviously that test of time and that old kind of style. And I think that's quite a good comment, actually. The fourth game, when it comes out, what is it going to look like? Is it going to actually hold up, right, to that?
They've got two options, right? It's going to be a case of bending the modern audience to their will. To make them enjoy Time Splitters as it was, or they are going to have to change the formula somewhat to suit the modern market.
And I think that's where there is that slight worry, because obviously, right, as we kind of spoke about, the industry has changed so much in the time that the original games came out. Games have changed so much in the time of that, not just FPS games, but games in general, right? DLCs are a thing now, expansion passes are a thing now, season passes are a thing now, gas models, all these kind of things that were not a thing when Time Splitters first came out are now a thing again.
That's it.
And like we said, Time Splitters, not only the age you were when we played it, right, but there was that nostalgia and that kind of childhood kind of love that came with it, because back then games were a lot more simple, weren't they?
They were. You cast your mind back. There were no weapon attachments. Mm. There were no prestiges. Mm. There was no experience level.
But even that, right, there was no patching. There was no things like that. There was none of that business. You know, online only got added in the third one, and it was very rudimentary again, right? It was, you know, these are things that this franchise has never encountered before, you know? And I think the franchise personified that good old-fashioned gaming fun, you know? Everything was available to the player because the characters, right? The amount of characters you can play in the Time Splitters games throughout all of the games, right? Staggering number of characters, isn't there? Yeah, none of them are locked behind any form of paid content, any form of DLC, any form of Game of the Year edition, nothing like that. Every single character can be earned through hard work and gameplay. And that's it.
And I think they need to be careful with the way that they execute it.
Exactly.
Because you're never going to make everybody happy, right? There are always going to be naysayers.
Always, 100%.
There's a right way to do this, and there's a really wrong way to do it.
There is a very wrong way to do this. And like I said, there is also a right way to do this. But there's also a hard way to do this, right? And that is just owning up to the fact, right, that games are different nowadays. Games have changed.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, for a game to be successful, right, it has to appeal to a lot of people and not just the hardcore fan base, you know?
Yeah.
That loved it and supported it for years.
Not only that, but it also has to support that bottom line at the end of the day.
100%. 100%, man. It has to do that. So
that's how a lot of studios make. That's how they break bread these days, right?
100%,
how they can fulfill that bottom line. It's by selling additional content,
exactly,
to bolster those numbers.
And DLCs, you know, wouldn't exactly be bad for it, right? Because they extend the life of the game, whether it, you know, be good or bad, right? The DLCs do serve a very important role in the modern game framework, right? They do extend and keep a game going, and for some games, that's very important. You know, for example, fighting games have a notoriously high turnaround time for players, unbelievably so, right? If a fighting game comes up broken, chances are it dies off very quickly, very quickly. So season kind of passes and stuff like that have been sort of very important for fighting games because it keeps people playing with, you know, free updates and whatnot and fixes, but also by providing more content, more characters to play as, right? Very important for those games. Other games like Fortnite, for example, player attention span isn't really great. So new things, new characters, new weapons, new modes, all that kind of stuff goes in over time. And like we said, sadly, that is sort of the GaaS motto now. So who knows, honestly, what they're going to do and how they're going to approach this. Obviously, like we said, they've got OG people at the company working on this, you know. Have these guys kept at it? Have they kept looking at industry trends, right? What are we going to see? Is it going to be a blatant, nonchalant return to form completely, unapologetically, you know? Is it going to be exactly like the originals were back in the day? I have no idea.
Yeah, it's certainly going to be a tightrope app for them, and I do not envy the position that they're in. But
no, it's going to be a balanced act for sure. And
this
it
is
will
also
be...
it's also a very exciting time as well.
It's 100% exciting, yeah, because it's finally we're getting what we thought we'd never get, right?
Yeah,
and I think, you know, as a fan, as a long running fan of the game series, like, you know, we said what this game series has meant to us and done for us, right? To have that actually on the horizon again is unbelievable. You know, it's the same I got when I found out that, you know, Oddworld Inhabitants making a new Oddworld game finally. It was unbelievable, right? It's that childhood nostalgia has finally come back, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I just hope that, you know, they do a good job of it, you know, and I know for a fact that I'll get the game irrespective.
Yeah.
Because I want to give them my money because it's been so long. I'm like, please, you know, it's the least I can do to support the studio that gave me such enjoyment back in the day, you know? Hours and hours of enjoyment playing the original series.
Yeah, and you know, long live Free Radical, mate. That's what
long
I'm going to say.
Long live Free Radical. With that, my man, I think we should jump in with deep dive the very first game.
Yeah,
where it all started.
Absolutely. You know, I've got kind of a bit of a brief overview about the Time Splitters series in general. Because
sure.
Obviously, I am aware that there may be people listening to this that have never played the Time Splitters
games,
right?
Of course, man. I say
shame on you for not playing them, but that's okay. That's why I forgive you.
But luckily, Zach is here with his hot tips on the Time Splitters series.
I don't know about that, but...
this is Fact Corner. Fact Corner time.
Yeah, that's it, mate. Yeah. But, the main kind of overview of the story, if you will, it's all based in and around time travel, time and space travel.
I mean, we get very loose with the storyline in the first game, right? Like,
what storyline, right?
Yeah, the first game, for all intents and purposes, has literally no storyline. I mean, I don't think it makes any sense whatsoever from trying to, like, rope together any kind of narrative, does it?
Yeah, like, I mean, you've got to try really hard. Like, imagination, you know, is at the forefront of that game. The strong point of the games, though, is it's kind of like dynamic storytelling in terms of the variety of time periods and locations that you have to blast your way through. You know, one moment you're in the sands of Egypt, basically tomb raiding like in The Mummy. The next moment you're aboard a space station fighting, you know, time traveling aliens. Right? It's wild and wacky.
The future works in mysterious ways.
It does, yeah. It's totally madcap, and it's just a lot of fun. There's a lot of very like unique and satirical characters in the games as well. Like we can use Captain Ash as an example, right? From the first.
Oh yeah, Captain Ash.
He's your stereotypical like stiff upper lip British gent from the turn of the 20th century, right? Yeah. He is like from the early 1900s.
Also, kind of one of the kind of face characters of the series, right? He's a character that appears in all games.
Yeah, he's a mainstay character. He is in every iteration of the game.
Every iteration of the game.
And he always, you know, he's great. Like, he's so much fun as a character. He's like, my God, you know, he's like the exactly what you'd imagine a British gent from the early 1900s.
Oh yeah, it definitely definitely is like heavily stereotyped, right, with some of his characters.
That's the thing. Like the sense of humor that Free Radical brings to the Time Splitters games, it's almost Monty Python-esque in certain.
I think that is definitely their like British heritage, right, showing off, you know.
Oh, 100%. Like, it is absolutely fantastic.
Right. I think it's stuff you wouldn't have got if Free Radical was actually like an American company, for example.
Yeah, that's it. And it's like there's a little bit of like the studio's identity stamped in those games 100%. Through its sense of humor,
you know,
and the way that they execute certain scenes and the games in general.
Satire, right? And sarcasm, right, plays such a big emphasis in British humor that it doesn't with any other kind of humor out there, right? Especially like American humor, you know. Totally different, right, isn't it, to English humor?
Yeah.
100% different.
Almost everything. Like you were talking about, you know, with those like rumored screenshots with like the Master Chief logo, or like with the Master Chief monkey and the Gears of War logo and stuff like that. Everything is like a parody, it feels like, in this. You know, it's like a parody of real life, or it's a parody of like pop culture or something that you might
massively
know,
influenced, right?
Definitely, yeah. But there is always one constant throughout all of the games, and that's the Time Splitters. They are an evil race of aliens that jump across time, altering and twisting and distorting human history.
And obviously the namesake of the series is all right. So that's where we got it from.
Yeah. Yeah, the game is named after the main antagonists of the series, and their kind of hope is to wipe us out utterly, you know, by going back to pivotal points in human history and altering and changing the course of human history.
Sort of like a butterfly affecting everything, right? You know,
exactly,
by changing something in the past, you know, you're somehow going to affect the future.
So our brave kind of heroes and heroines that are the main characters throughout. We'll use the first one as the prime example here. You will play. There are two main characters for every scenario that you play. There's quite a few different missions to run through, but the main characters that you play, they are stepping up to the plate basically to take the Time Splitters head on and to disrupt their plans and to kind of bring the time. The time continuum back to where it should be by kind of erasing, you know, it might be collecting a certain artifact that's affecting the space-time continuum in that zone and removing it from said space-time continuum to bring things back to normal.
And this is sort of how I think, like, the first game gets a little bit lost, doesn't it? Because it sort of outlines a sort of story, but it doesn't actually kind of follow through with any of the aspects that make, like, a game have a story, you know? Like cutscenes, dialogue, any of that business is non-existent in the first
game.
There's none of that in the first game at all.
And even that synopsis that I've given you there, that's me trying to piece together my perspective.
Pure ad lib, baby.
Because, yeah, like you don't really get much of that.
Not at all. Not in the slightest, game. Right? Like you said, this is, you know, you described it a good way, right? Like Time Splitters 1 is almost like a proof of concept game. The first beginning point for what would then very much change in number 2 and 3, where the game's actually got an official storyline, right? Complete with cutscene, voice acting, the works, didn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And it is like the campaign is just, it's a basically just a whole bunch of time trials. They are just scenarios. You can play it and try and get the best time on it. And that can if you beat the certain time on the certain difficulty, you can unlock characters and maps and so on and so forth. But you are just running through a series of different environments with different enemies, different weapons, blah, blah, blah.
And ironically, it also suffers from a bit of the old Back to the Future scenario, doesn't it? Where it kind of inaccurately predicts the future.
It does, yeah.
Cyber Den level, right?
Yeah, Cyber Den, it's set in like 2005 and you've got cyborgs running around with Gatling guns and stuff.
Yeah, like
that,
the world is a completely, like, it was like apocalyptic, like Hablock type environment, wasn't it? With cyborgs with like blades and arms and stuff like that. Like,
you know, I'm pretty sure that the Planet X mission, you know, the one where you play as Sebastian Photon and you're on Planet X fighting the aliens.
Yeah,
that was actually, and you've got like plasma carbines and stuff like that. That was actually set in 2020.
And Galactic Travel as well, right?
Yeah. So, so who knows?
It does suffer from a bit of the Back to the Future syndrome, where it sort of like predicts the future, but obviously now we're already there, right? And the world does not look like that.
I think though, I could probably do a little bit of cheeky fan-made retcon there, though.
Oh yeah.
And I would argue that, yes, okay, so Sebastian and Angel Perez, they are humanoid, but they might not necessarily be from Earth.
True, very true, yeah.
So they might be fighting on Planet X, they might be fighting the aliens, they might be trying to fight the Time Splitters.
Also, because of that, obviously,
they might not be human.
Because of that obvious, you know, intervention as well with the Time Splitters and the Time Crystals, right? If anything, that could potentially have, you know, resulted in that's what 2015 becomes because of the intervention.
Exactly,
by the Time
that.
Splitters, right?
That's, yeah, and I think that's what they try to impress upon you in those in the game, is that the Time Splitters are, because they're altering our future and our past and so on and so forth, that things that aren't supposed to be there are there now because of a direct result of that, right? It's the cause and effect kind of thing.
Definitely.
Again, like the butterfly effect you were talking
about. And the Time Splitters in this game, they actually look kind of wild, don't they? Like visually.
Yeah, they're mostly bones, and they kind of remind me a little bit of the Necron flayed ones from the Warhammer universe, right?
Yeah, but they've got that kind of
like bones, and they've just got like bits of skin and flesh draped over them.
And ironically, they also kind of have they also kind of change into more like kind of what some of the zombies look like in the later games, really, in this game, don't they? Like in the other games, their design changes very heavily, doesn't it? In 2 and 3, the Time Splitters design alters very, very big.
Well, they're all different. They're all different, kind of like
they're like variants, aren't they? Of like
variants, exactly.
Of the Time Splitters.
And again, it's almost like not only does our history and our kind of like like what we know to be time change, but they're also kind of altering their own timeline by doing that as well. So you can kind of argue that what they've done in the first, second, and third games has affected them as a species as well as humans.
They're very curious, aren't they? Like the designs, and like you said, with that kind of altering, right? Altering of the of what they are. Because like in the second one, they're called like Reapers, aren't they? Reaper Splitters.
Yes, yeah. And then in 3, they're the Berserk ones. They're feral, aren't they?
You know, I quite like those ones.
Big nasty teeth. And they're great. They're probably my favourites, the Berserk ones.
Berserker Splitters, yeah.
Yeah, they're very, very cool.
Yeah, yeah, those are really cool. To be honest, I say, like, obviously you're right. They are kind of, a divergence of the Time Splitter kind of genos in a way. But obviously, like, they are sort of the only ones that sort of appear, don't they, in the game, in that game, or in their relevant games. So, like, the Berserker Splitter is sort of the only one that appears in 3, doesn't it?
It is, yeah. So, I mean,
the Reaper one obviously appearing in 2 primarily.
Yeah, With the Splitters, you can see how they, in the third one, very much in the same way, like I'll liken it to Gears of War 3, you know, where the Locust, they go kind of feral.
Yeah.
Exactly the same thing kind of happens with the Time Splitters. They have almost, they've kind of got to a stage of desperation, very much like humanity has.
Mm.
And they're all kind of like, now we're all on a level playing field, you know, the Time Splitters don't have the upper hand anymore when they're the Berserkers. They're just feral beasts on instinct now, just jumping through time and space to just destroy whatever they can. You know, all of that like premeditated, calculated kind of death that they had envisioned in the second and first ones, that's kind of fallen by the wayside now, and they're just like chaotic beasts now instead.
Yeah, the storyline takes goes a little bit crazy, doesn't it, in ports and places like that.
It definitely does. Yeah,
and it's quite interesting to see how they kind of advanced on from the very first game, because some interesting facts for you here, which you may or may not know, both you, Zach, and the listeners, is that the original game was only made by 18 people.
Yeah.
in 16 short months and was only done on a budget of 500k, and that was it.
And it's great. Like, you think of the, and it kind of, when you look at it from that perspective, you understand why it feels like a proof of concept.
You do, yeah, you do, because it is 18 people, right, to put out a game like the second and the third ones. Obviously, you can tell, right, in the second and the third ones, right, when more people got involved, right, in the development of the game, because we had cutscenes, we had voice acting, we had fully established modes, we had way more kind of complex challenge modes, didn't we, and kind of story levels.
Yeah, that's it. You know, all elements that were a part of the first one, but they were in those infant steps.
Yeah,
right?
Very rudimentary, but obviously that's what started it, didn't it? That's what began that progression to, you know, to where we were, where we got to in the end of it when the third one came out. So it's staggering, really, to think that a group so small with such limited resources as well, like 500k, especially nowadays in today's kind of market, right, making a video game, that's like nothing, right? That's incredibly short budget.
It's a really impressive feat. 18 people in as many months, right?
16 months, right?
16 months, right?
I can't believe, like, and I can't imagine what it must have been like to be at Free Radical during those 16 months, because that would have been like the wild west of like game development. You know, that'd have been like the OG days of game development. It would have been fascinating to have been a fly on the wall, you know, to see what it would have been like there when they were doing that. Because, like I said, that was such a different, I think, industry to what we have now. You know, that was like crazy, and I imagine it would have been such a creative space as well.
Not only just to, you know, to create a product and get it out there, but also to create a product knowing that once it's out there, you can't
edit it. Yeah, you can't change this. Right, this was, like I said, it was sort of the Wild West days. It was unbelievable the amount of stuff that they would go through to kind of fix and make it work and playable. Because, like we said, right, there was no patches, there wasn't a DLC content. Games couldn't be fixed in like post, right, like they can be now. When the game was live, the game was live. That game had to fucking work, you know? That game had to consistently work, you know? Obviously, bugs exist, you know, whatever, but the game had to essentially be, you know, completely playable without any major problems, you know? Crashing, just, that wouldn't be a thing. That would be fixed back in the day. It would be it. The game would be done. It'd be buried, right?
Yeah, and it is amazing because they pulled it off.
They did. They pulled it off incredibly well. And they do say that one of the biggest challenges they faced when getting Transmitters 1 off the ground was the cooperative mode of the game. Obviously, the game can go full four-player co-op, can't it? Which, back in the day, that's quite a feat. That's quite a feat for the hardware, to have four players simultaneously playing with no issues. And because of this, the team had to actually abandon using the brand new anti-aliasing system within the PS2. So for people who don't know, anti-aliasing is a system that makes kind of lines smoother in video games. So without it turned on, you'll see that some lines are quite jagged, sort of like the lines of characters and stuff like that. You'll notice they have like a bit of a jagged ish to them. And the PS2 had a brand new anti-aliasing system that they were really pushing in the new games. And sadly, the studio just couldn't use it in Transmitters 1. And I think that's partly why Transmitters 1 does look a bit more rougher than, you know, the other games. Not just because when it came out, right? Obviously, it was a launch title. It was very early days. But I think that's why it looks noticeably kind of more kind of jaggy and more kind of old nowadays than it would have beforehand, right?
It hasn't aged kindly, the game, as much as we love it, right? There are, it definitely looks like a game from its time.
100%. Like, I remember,
that's
when
okay.
we,
that's
I remember when
fine.
We touched on it again a little while ago, right? When I was visiting back home, and we had a play of it, didn't we?
We did.
And which was fantastic fun, obviously. But yeah, you could tell, right? Like, you can see the jaggedness now in that game, in the first game, around the characters, around everything in the environment, you know?
Yeah,
and
especially because we played that at the same time, like in the same evening we played Tekken Tag, right?
We did. And I never launched Tower.
How smooth does that look? Like, that still looks good today.
Buttery,
I think,
buttery smooth, yeah.
It's still good, right? It's,
you know,
it's kind of slower than the newer ones, right?
100%, yeah. Definitely doesn't resemble current Tekken, right, in that sense, but you are completely right, yeah. And for Radical, that's what they had to do. They said that they just could not get the game running at a stable frame rate with four-player cooperative, with that engage, they just couldn't do it. And thankfully, you know, when the second one came out and the third one came out, by that time, obviously, they got a lot more used to using the system. More people had joined for Radical, obviously, given their ideas. The company ballooned in size and, you know, they actually got it working in the end. So that's why 2 and 3, vastly different games, but also very different games from an art direction standpoint as well.
Yeah, I mean, from a production value perspective, you know, it definitely... it's a telling sign, you know, and you can tell where they've cut corners and they've done the best that they can with the budget and the time budget that they had as well. But that's okay. Like, that is, again, that's absolutely fine. There's still a variety of modes there. There are plenty of characters, unique characters, like we've said
before. There is, completely right. The characters in that game are just so wacky and zany, right? The weapons are crazy. And I think that is where the real fun of one comes out, right? Not in the fact of the game it is, right? It's 100% the real fun is that the multiplayer mode, the rich arcade mode, you know, being able to sit down with your friends, experience it in true four-player co-op mode, The joy is just unbelievable, isn't it?
It is. And its greatest strength is its simplicity, I think, in that respect.
It is 100%, because it's very simple to pick up and play and you get on with it, you know? And yeah, I mean, literal hours, right? Literal hours of fun we've had with that game over our entire lives playing it and just having such a good time with it and getting lost in it. And, you know, and this is just the first game, you know, like I said, before they added an actual story mode. You know, it was unbelievable. It was almost like it was a love letter to the shooters that came before it. You know, like we said, it bled their DNA. It bled GoldenEye. It bled Perfect Dark. It bled those OG shooter games. And it was very much a product of its time, right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why more now than ever that it's important that identity is kept, I think, you know,
intact,
and
100%,
and we celebrate it and remember it, because again, you know, like we have seen over the course of our lives, we've seen games come along leaps and bounds in some respects, but it has lost a little bit of something.
It has. That's what I mean. That's what I say. When I imagine being back in Free Radical during that time would have been such an experience to see and to be a part of. Like, it would have been so creative. It would have been so crazy. You know, every game decision would have been made with a purpose and not because it has to make, you know, oodles of money and stuff like that. Right. Obviously money is always the goal behind every studio, but there wouldn't have been any kind of decisions that would have poked it towards just making more money. You know, just with that as a goal, it would have been a case of this is being put in because it's so creative, you know, giving the players everything in the game. All you had to do was unlock it, right? And that's such a thing from back in that. That's such a mechanic that comes from the PlayStation kind of 2 early era, doesn't it? And the PS1 era, that era of playing video games.
Yeah. And, you know, and one thing I will give credit for Time Splitters as well is that you could never cheese it. It's a case of
you had to sit there and do it.
You
right?
have to sit there and you have to earn it.
Yeah. But like I said, that's what's so good about it, though, right? Is that nothing is gated behind any kind of money whatsoever. Everything is there. You just have to go out and do it, go out and get it. You know, complete the challenges, get the highest scores to unlock the characters, right? You know, I can't count the amount of times I spent doing some of the challenges in the later games. Holy hell. Like, it was unbelievable. The melon one, shooting the melons of the monkeys.
Yeah. Like, and you know, the thing is that the challenges they made their debut in the first one.
They did. It's a feature that was carried through all of the way.
It was. Yeah. And the challenge modes, again, you know, they give you access to unlock characters, you know, maps, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
The challenges range from everything from like the behead the undead challenges, which were always my personal favorite.
That's a good one.
We've got to survive for as long as you can and shoot as many zombies' heads off with the shotgun as you possibly can.
Another good thing, actually, Zach, now you touched on that they put in the game that I've just remembered, is obviously something that also followed through to the other games was the map maker mode, right?
Map maker, which was that was going to be one of my final points.
Good man. Yeah, the map maker was, oh my god, it was unbelievable, wasn't it? It was something that I hadn't really come across ever.
I mean,
at that point.
Realistically, you know, and this might be a bit of a controversial statement here, but this was Halo's Forge before Halo's Forge was a thing.
I mean, you're not wrong, dude. Literally, this was it in a very rudimentary form. But
in
it was
a very rudimentary form.
It was it, right? And obviously, I imagine you were going to touch on this as well, right? But this is something that has also followed them through to every game, hasn't it?
Every single game.
It was never
cut. It got better with every game as well.
It was never cut once from a game. This is the type of feature, that nowadays would 100% be cut if the budget was too high. 100%. Trust me. It would not see the light of day in a game nowadays, if budget was tight. You know, release was getting soon, more important things had to be made, honestly. So it's incredible that they kept Mapmaker throughout every single iteration of the game. And not just that, though, they made it better in every single one, didn't they?
They did. They actually did.
Absolutely better in every single one.
what I found incredible with it as well is, you know, you can literally play around with everything. You obviously have like your room tiles that you put down and lighting and stuff like that, but it's even down to the script. You can mess around with the scripting of the game, so you can change the scripting of how a certain character, like an AI character, is going to react.
This is a PlayStation 2 game. This is a PlayStation 2 series, yeah? There is very few series, yeah, that exist on that platform that can let you do that kind of stuff. You know, hell, there's not many games nowadays that let you do that kind of stuff, right, without actually modding, you know? This was official, in the game, all done, and all presented in a way that you could do it with purely just the game. Nothing else was needed. You could do it entirely with the game. You weren't expected to have a dev kit, have a computer, have any other source of external things. You could do this 100% in the game, and I find it incredible. I find Mapmaker absolutely incredible and fascinating.
Yeah, it is, and it's a real... It's such a cool thing, right? Because it's literally the devs giving the players, who we'll refer to as the children here, giving the children the toy box and going,
yeah,
make your own fun. Wow, amazing, right?
It's and I know for a fact, right? The number one, the first one, was a bit strange, wasn't it? Because the first time Splitters game, it had sort of, there was a very limited amount, wasn't there, in the original Mapmaker. In comparison to what came before, after it, because holy shit, right? When we talk about those games, we're going to go into details, but like, let's just say the map, honestly, it went leaps and bounds, didn't it, in the future games?
Yeah.
But obviously in the original one, right, there was very few tile sets. And also, there wasn't really a pattern, was there, with them? So you could sort of make some really weird maps, couldn't you?
Yeah, like I mean, it really was. It was just like I said, it's like literally having a toy box full of blocks and just seeing what you could slap together.
Yeah, you could sort of do all sorts of weird shit, couldn't you, in there?
But it was a lot of fun. Like,
and there was a gothic tile set.
Gothic tile set.
An industrial one, an alien one, a spaceport one, and a very basic, almost like grey block one.
Yeah, that was just like your stock.
I think they called it like virtual. But it was basically like grey block, essentially.
Yeah, which is quite interesting, actually, because there was an actual proper map, wasn't it? And it was the VR one in Time Splitters 3.
That was really good.
That was cool.
But
yeah, like Mapmaker was such an awesome tool to give the players, and it just added to that replayability, because it was like, oh, so you've played all of the maps that we've made for you. Now let's see what you can do.
Yeah, make your own maps. Yeah.
Yeah, like. That is just such, what a genius idea that was.
Oh, honestly, oh man, that's so good. That's so cool. Like I can't stop gushing over Time Splitters, like, and the stuff in the game, because, like I said, man, can you imagine they bring back Mapmaker in the modern game? What they could do with that?
Oh man, yeah, and like I mentioned with Halo Forge, right? You see how good that is now.
Forge is crazy, now, right, isn't it? And Doom had a similar system as well, didn't they?
Doom, yeah.
Doom had a similar one. Like, unbelievable. But I just, honestly, I can't begin to think what they could do, because, like you said, Forge has gone on such leap and bounds. Man, what are they going to do? What are they going
to
do? Right?
I think personally they would be foolish not to implement that into the new one, because it is such a part of the Time Splitter pedigree, right?
Such
because
a it's rich been there part since of the history, isn't it?
Definitely, yeah. That would be like them saying, okay, so Capture the Bag is no longer going to be a mode in arcade. You'd be like, what?
Or virus mode, either.
Yeah, forget virus mode. Like, not anymore. Like,
no.
Are you serious? What?
Yeah, how dare you? How dare you, sir?
Awful.
Interesting little... Interesting little fact, just a quick one. This actually is about Time Splitters 2, but I've only just found out about it, which is kind of interesting. Did you know that Time Splitters 2 had a gothic tile set in it, but it was actually removed from the game before the release?
Oh, really?
Because of glitched tiles. However, with an action replay for GameCube, you can actually access the tiles.
Oh, okay.
It is sort of broken, though. The Gothic tile set is called 4 in the Mapmaker menu. It's sort of like a dark 12th century castle type thing. There's lots of tiles that also feature lava. It was discovered by a hacker, a data miner, that came across the code.
Oh, very nice.
And you can access them now, but obviously they are kind of busted. There's a lot of models that don't have textures and stuff like that in there, and it's, it looks like it was just pulled before release. A little quinky dink for you there.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, they obviously that close to release. If it didn't work, they wouldn't want it in the game. Like we've said, exactly. Fix it, right?
Exactly, so, right, yeah. 100%.
Yeah, just to not have it in the game. Out of sight, out of mind, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think there's only one thing that I would want to discuss about the first one.
Go on.
Just to wrap us up. And I think it's the soundtrack. I think we need to discuss. Mm. We just need to discuss a little bit about the sound design.
For sure.
You know, for the weapons, the enemies, and the soundtrack itself, because yeah. I feel like that again is another one of those iconic parts of Time Splitters. It's the sound design. The weapon sounds are brilliant. Like they're just like so iconic for that time.
Yeah.
I mean, you haven't lived until you've held the fun button down on that minigun and loosed all 60 rounds outright. It's just great.
yeah, 100%. And the sound design was actually done by one of the founders, Graham Norgate. And he actually composed quite a lot of Time Splitters' sound himself back when the company was obviously really small, which is quite interesting, right? That he had a hand of doing that, and he actually got his start, obviously, like a lot of them did, once again in Rare. And his first project was write music for the Game Boy game Donkey Kong Land, right? and then he eventually obviously helped out on the bigger games like GoldenEye, and you know that's when he went over into Time Splitters, and then was involved in every single Time Splitters game then on.
But that the music is. That's just another level for me. I really, really like the music. I think, especially the period specific music as well. Like, I'll be honest with you. A little bit earlier today, before we started recording, I went back and I had a little listen to the soundtrack from the first.
Oh, really?
To get myself into the mood.
Nice.
Wow! Like, go back and listen to the Tomb one, man, yeah. And it is like. You can close your eyes. You're there in the sands of Egypt.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
Brilliant. It's so well done. It's really, really good.
Oh, that's kind of yeah. It had a very unique kind of flavor, didn't it? To it.
And every single
level, you know, you could get the vibe instantly, couldn't you? Of what the level was about. As soon as you
really
heard the
could,
music.
Yeah. Without even seeing the level, you could close your eyes and you'd know what type of level you're on. Is this more of a horror-related one, or you know, like you listen to the village or the mansion, you know you're in a horror setting.
Mm, mm. Oh yeah, completely. I always loved the absolutely lovely Planet X one, Planet X soundtrack.
Planet X. Both Planet X soundtracks, and I think the second one in Time Splitters 2, The Return to Planet X, that is by far the best.
Oh yeah,
track
yeah. That one slaps. That one slaps. Unbelievable, right?
Yeah.
It's so good. It's so good.
Like, even back then, before Darude Sandstorm was a meme, I would still say step aside Darude Sandstorm because Return to Planet X is coming through. You know?
Oh my god! Yeah, like
it was so good.
I can't imagine it would have been so interesting to have to experience that game like the age I am now. But back in that day, you know what I mean? I wonder kind of what I would have thought about that game, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I'd be curious to ask like maybe one of my uncles or something like that.
Yeah.
I know I got some uncles in the family that are big into games and stuff like that. I'd be curious to ask them and ask their opinion on what they thought of Time Splitters back in the day, and
yeah.
whether they hold it with as much reverence as we do.
Oh yeah, yeah, completely. Ironically, I have just discovered after doing a little bit of googling, one of those rumored Time Splitters 4 concepts that leaked. Do you remember seeing this?
Let me have a look.
Do you remember seeing that?
That doesn't ring a bell.
That was one of them that came out, and it was for our viewers out there. It is a nun wearing like her kind of habit, but it's kind of cut and torn up. She's got the word saint right across her chest, and she's got a big old chainsaw, and she's about to hack up some zombies. So very, very Time Splitters 3-esque, right, in the design.
Yeah, I bet she's one of like the Joe Beth Casey archetype.
Ironically, apparently it was actually referenced to be an older Joe Beth Casey.
Oh, right.
Every time, but it's 4, and it was apparently meant to have been a potential concept for a horde mode in the game.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And also, there was a concept of a monkey in a man-sized night mech called Sir Chimpalot.
Yeah, definitely on brand there.
That would be hilarious if we had had Sir Chimpalot, right?
Literally, from Time Splitters 2 onwards, it was all about monkeys.
The monkeys were big. Like, when we get into discussing, you know, Time Splitters 2, Time Splitters 3, right, the monkeys were became sort of like a mascot, didn't they, for the series, in a way.
Yeah, they did. They did. But, even before that, you had those kind of, like, there were those more novelty characters that were left serious, like the Gingerbread Man, Duckman, Drake.
Yeah, you had the weird characters in you that were kind of just thrown in, weren't they?
Just kind of
dropped in. And the monkey became very iconic. Like, I think that's maybe why they started to use it in the Time Splitters 4 mix-ups, right? Where they had, we've got, the monkey dressed as Master Chief, or the monkey is the cog symbol from, Gears of War, right? That kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, because, they already had, like, in Time Splitters 3, they had the RoboCop reference with RoboChimp, right?
Yeah. And then,
like, instead of having the pistol in his leg, he'd, like, have a banana and he'd point it at people. So. RoboChimp.
Oh, my God, he did, didn't he? Yeah.
He did, yeah.
I thought you were dropping your Harry Tipper then as well.
Harry Tipper.
Yeah, I thought you did like a Harry Tipper impression.
Wait, I'm going to have to save that for the next episode, I think.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's better for the next one, right, isn't it? Because I guess the character in the first game is not really what he is later on, is he?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. He's another original. Mm-hmm. He's in the first time.
There is a few, isn't there, that obviously are on all the games, but they've completely kind of shaken them up, haven't they, and sort of how they look. And also,
I think Tipper's one of those ones that stays... He stays looking... fairly similar.
Yeah, it's more the voice, isn't it, right? It's more the mannerisms they give him.
The thing is with him, he starts off in the first one, he's a detective, right? But by 2 and 3, he's like a James Bond level super spy.
By number 3, right, it's sort of like sort of goes a little bit Austin Powersy, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
If we're being very very serious, by the third game, he's very much becomes this almost Austin Powers-esque character.
He is Austin Powers with a mustache.
Yeah, who is once again, it just bleeds satire, right? The game is just extremely satirical in its designs and the way it kind of portrays its characters. It's that, I guess it's that flavour, that British humour flavour, right? That the game's kind of drenched in. Here's a question for you though, man. Did you have a favorite multiplayer mode from number one?
From the very first one.
The very first one, yeah.
I can tell you which one there I
obviously,
didn't like.
There obviously wasn't that many modes, wasn't there, in the first one. The second one exploded, and the third one obviously knocked out of the park, but the first one sort of had very kind of normal modes, didn't it? Very safe modes.
It did. The one I didn't like at all, though, was Escort.
Yeah, Escort was a bit trash, wasn't it? Yeah.
Where you had that NPC character to defend, and he would just walk as slow as humanly possible.
But in all fairness, right, I think that Escort is just—it's just a shit game type in every kind of game.
That's a
throwaway
mode.
It's just crap for everything, though, isn't it? Right, let's be honest. Yeah, is Escort ever been a very good like game mode? And anytime you've got to walk after and follow, slow as shit NPC characters that do nothing, right? It's a terrible time, isn't it?
It's irksome.
Escort quests, mate. Escort quests in video games are one of the worst designs for a video game. And I always like when some studios do go out there to make their way and they make escort quests fun and inventive, because I think it's a design that's just gets very stale very quickly. And it can lead to very quick frustration as well.
Yeah, it's just nice when the person that you're escorting can actually defend themselves.
But doesn't have the IQ of a lemon.
Yeah.
Is actually competent and moves around and doesn't, just doesn't walk into shit and get killed, because the AI, but, right, for the first game is, it's
terrible.
It's AI, right? It's,
very rudimentary, like some of the other features in the game, right?
Yeah, it obviously is very, like I said, it's a product of it's a bygone era, isn't it?
Yeah. I think, though, if I had to pick any mode from the first one,
yes,
I think Capture the Bag is my favorite one. And I like that because normally in every other game it's capture the flag, right? But in Time Splitters, they went for bags instead of flags. So I just liked that. That was a team-based game, obviously red versus blue. And it was just about scoring as many bags as you possibly could. Now, I used to like being a bit of a cheeky monkey, and just I used to like sitting on my objective and just ambushing people when they would go and try and capture the bag. I was a bit of a camper before.
But back in the camping of the old school, mate.
Exactly, mate. Yeah,
you were an old school camper.
What about yourself? Did you have a particular mode from the first one that you can remember that you liked?
Yeah, to be fair, man, it was probably I quite like Amateur Bag as well. I also quite liked Bag Tag. I thought Bag Tag was really good.
Bag Tag, awesome. Yeah, that's a good one. That's the, like the free-for-all mode, and you've got to hold the bag for the longest, yeah, right?
Bag Tag was kind of a fun one.
That's a good one, yeah. That's really good with friends because you can really dick people over.
100%, yeah.
Oh, it's so good, yeah.
But in terms of maps, mate, there is only one choice for multiplayer maps, mate.
The bank.
And that was bank, 100% bank.
Yeah.
There was no other map, mate, as far as I was concerned, right? Bank was the map back in the day, you know? How many fucking times did we play bank?
Well, I mean, that was the case, right? We'd set it up so everybody would spawn with dual miniguns, yeah, and we would just sit in the bank and wait for them to run through that doorway. Yeah, we just rinse.
Oh, bank was so fucking good, yeah. It was such a good map. It was such a good map. And it
I
was
will
so,
also say, from the first set of maps as well, bank is definitely top tier. I'd also say that I really enjoyed the streets as well. That had a really kicking soundtrack, and that was a really good map because there were lots of, like, there were like multiple routes that you could take, so you could opt to go through the buildings and try and get a bit of the high ground, but then you're obviously prone to being flanked from both sides, or you can just run straight through no man's land through the streets, you know, there's like snow coming down on you and whatnot. That was a really cool map. I liked that one as well. And then I think I really liked the Chinese restaurant.
Chinese restaurant was a good one. That was one that also came back, didn't it? They did a revival of that map, didn't they, in later games?
They did, yeah. They brought that back for I know they brought that back for two. I can't remember if they brought it back for three.
I don't know. I feel like they did. There was a challenge with the bricks, wasn't there?
Yeah,
it was because they also was the Karen Carcass challenge was there as well, wasn't it?
Was it?
I thought it was in the chef's room.
Been a while. Or maybe the Carrion Carcass maybe that one was in the kitchen in the mansion.
Oh, maybe it was the kitchen in the mansion, yeah.
Because it's a really small box room, isn't it, right? And you've got like the tables.
Were you playing as Carrion Carcass, but you had the bricks and you were smashing up the cutlery and that in the Chinese restaurant?
The one I remember.
For some reason, I had an idea that Carrion Carcass is, for some reason, features in that map at some point.
Yeah, you may very well be right. The one I can remember with the Carrion Carcasses is when you're playing as the Bistro Butcher, yeah?
The Gaston Butcher.
Yeah, that's the one. And you've got the injector gun and you've got to explode the
carcass. Oh, good Lord, that was fucked up,
Those ones.
We're going to cover this in the next episode where we talk about 2 and 3 in more detail, but there were some parts of 3 that kind of fucked me up a little bit, I ain't going to lie. There was some weird
nightmare
shit in 3.
Fuel, mate.
There was some nightmare weird fuel. Shit in 3, which probably exemplifies maybe I shouldn't have played that game at the age you played that game, because there was some weird shit in number 3. Most notably the mansion level. Very fucking creepy. Everything on the level was not only really creepy, soundtrack was kind of haunting as well.
Yeah, it's like strings all the way through, right? Yeah. And not the nice, the no, nice
it's very
strings either.
Haunting and almost kind of melancholy at times. It's a bit like, this is kind of uneasy, isn't it? Oh, God.
And also zombies spawning with shotguns. It's actually, for me, pound for pound, I think Mansion is the hardest campaign mission.
Oh, yeah?
It's absolutely the hardest one for me because it is... They're really cheeky with the enemy spawns, and you'll get to a certain point, and then they'll just drop a zombie right in front of you with a shotgun, and you can die instantly from that.
Oh,
it's really you can only kill them by headshotting them, so it's like you can knock them over and they'll get back up. That's one thing I liked about that is that they stay true to the old like Romero style zombies of like you have to destroy the brain to kill the zombies. You can't just shoot them in the body.
Removing the head or destroying the brain.
Exactly. So.
I love
a nice cup of tea and waiting for it all to blow over.
How's that for a slice of fried gold?
Yeah, boy.
Actually, it was Nick Frost's birthday a few days ago, by the way.
Was it?
Yeah,
Happy birthday, Nick Frost.
Interesting little thing there. Yeah, there was lots of funny Facebook pictures of him and Simon Pegg having a good time. Do you know,
that's a very, very good little segue as well, right? Because in Shaun of the Dead, what game is he playing?
Shit, yeah. When he's sat on the sofa? I was going to potentially drop this one next episode, but we'll drop it now. He's playing Tilesplitters 2, obviously.
Tilesplitters 2.
Yeah, he's playing Tilesplitters 2. I remember seeing that for the first time, and you know the fucking Leonardo DiCaprio meme, mate.
Is that the one where he's pointing at the TV?
Yeah. That was me, I think, back in the day when I first saw that. I was like, oh my God, look,
it's my game.
It's fucking Tilesplitters, holy shit. And the thing is, right, the kind of the looks of Tilesplitters, the feel of Tilesplitters, right, you can it's so iconic, I think, if you played it growing up, right? You instantly know what it is because of the sound, the UI, you know. And for me, it was like you could instantly tell because of the guns and the pause screen, because you see the pause screen, don't you, briefly,
yeah,
when he's playing it, and you have the fucking health bars on either side, you know.
I even know what map he's playing.
Oh, it's mad,
it's the ice station map from Time Splitters 2.
Yeah,
he's playing that one, and he's got the P90s.
top left.
Top left. Player 2 has entered the game. Have you got work? Player 2 has left the game.
And he got work. Oh, dude. And also, like, it switches up, doesn't it? Because Ed's playing it, like, later on as well. And it's very, very good.
Yeah.
Very, very cool.
Yeah. Very good.
That's in the game. Little fact very quickly. I didn't know about this. I did just Google, the bank level on the Time Splitters wiki, which I've never really visited before. And apparently, the clock in the bank level, is actually synchronized to the PlayStation system clock.
Oh, really?
Yeah. As with the mall level as well, apparently. And apparently on the top of every hour, it actually makes a chime sound.
That's really good.
It's kind of interesting. Apparently, though, it's synchronized with -3 hour time zone, which is interesting.
Oh.
Not like, whatever the... So I don't understand. I think it's set to the PlayStation time zone and then -3 hours? I don't know. But kind of interesting if that's actually true. I don't know if that's real or not. Obviously, it's a wiki, right? So anyone can edit that. I think that's like Brazil or the Philippines or something like that.
So what you're telling me is that Time Splitters, the game, has its own time zone.
Apparently, yeah. So no idea. No, because -4 hours is Eastern time, which is New York area. I don't actually know what time zone that is. I feel like that might be a case of the wiki being edited by someone, maybe. I don't know. Or UTC -4 hours, Atlantic, Puerto Rico, maybe. Puerto Rican time? I don't know.
Could be a Puerto Rican bank. I don't know.
Unbelievable if that is actually true. I'm going to say big if true. You should go try that out, man. You should confirm that with us.
I'm gonna press X to doubt until proven
you've
otherwise.
You've got the system, man. You've got the hardware. You have the potential. You can check this for us and confirm if this is actually real or not. Because if it is, that's big. If it's not, you can get on there and be like, bullshit. And also there is apparently the letter R, which is hidden in the map as well, which is a throwback to Rare and the guys who worked at Rare back in the day.
Oh, brilliant. That's really good.
It's quite nice. Didn't we notice that either? So
actually in the style of the Rare logo.
I don't know if it is or not. I think it's just like a big R.
They might not have been able to get away with that for copyright.
Probably not, yeah. But that's kind of cute that they had that in, right? I don't know if it is. Like I said, this is a wiki, so who knows if this is actually real or not. But if it is, that's kind of nice, you know, and makes sense. Like, as I said, right, so many of the original studio were based there. Very, very interesting. The mall apparently has the exact same thing as that.
I like that.
Has a clock which works with the synchronized system clock in the -3 hour time zone. Oh, this
one
says,
we were talking in the PlayStation 2 episode, right, about all those little like gimmicky features that are kind of irrelevant these days. Yeah. But back in the day, they were really cool little talking points, weren't they?
Yeah, that's the thing. Okay, this one actually, the trivia goes into a bit more detail here, and it was right. It says that if you look at the clock in the mall, you'll notice that the time it displays synchronizes with the time of the system clock -3 hours. However, the signs in the shop displayed and the prices are in pounds and pence, right?
Yeah.
Which is obviously quite funny because England, again, English developer, yeah? But obviously it contradicts each other, right? Because there is no country in a -3 hour time zone that uses pounds and pence as a currency. Because obviously Britain doesn't have a -3 hour time zone, right? So it's like a complete contradiction. But kind of interesting.
Like the folks at Free Radical have just like made their own little sovereign state somewhere that actually uses pounds and pence.
Yeah. And I'm going to pull one out for a user on this wiki called Duck on Quack 248.
Brilliant.
Who put a post in the 25th of August 2020 saying, I wish I could get this map, but I can't beat Mansion on normal difficulty, sadly. Insert crying face here.
Yeah, no, I feel your pain,
so,
honestly.
Duck on Quack, you're not alone, because Mansion is a tough one.
My man, try and play it on hard. That's all I'm going to say. It's awful. It is awful.
It is terrible. Duck on Quack, if you happen to listen to this. I got you, fam.
Like I'm total empath in that respect. I get you.
Apparently, there's some dude here who commented from 2014 that he spotted a Domestos bottle in the shop as well.
Oh man, that's great.
That's fantastic. Holy hell, this wiki's got some fucking things on it, man. I tell you that. I'm after drawing some of this for next episode.
I think that's going to be a useful little
like I said, totally not validity here in the slightest, because this is a wiki and a fan wiki at that, so fucking God knows. But kind of funny.
Kind that's of okay. Funny. I like the whole, like, fuck it, we'll do it live kind of feel to it anyway.
Fuck it,
like,
we'll do it live.
Yeah, so.
But thank you ever so much, everyone, for listening to our ramble about the history, the sad and, you know, revival of Free Radical and the first Transporters game.
Yeah, we cannot wait to get into the second
part. Can't wait to talk about 2 and 3, because honestly, like I said, man, 1 was good, but 2 and 3 just... They completely changed up the game, didn't they?
We are about to kick it up another notch.
We're about to crank that shit up to 11.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you ever so much, everyone. And we look forward to seeing you again.
Until next time.
Take care.
Bye.